Pro Shop has a lot of vendor rating built in, right? So with every line item of a PO I send a vendor, I can rate them on a scale of 1 to 5.
And Mikey's getting Pro Shop a hell of a plug.
I don't know. Right. Paul doesn't even have to show up for the episode and he gets a plug. Man, well, in that case, I'm drinking out of a Hennig mug.
Send him a bill, Nick.
Right. Hey, Jason Zenger here. You should know more about AMT, the Association for Manufacturing Technology. They are the industry representative group that gives us IMTS and more, including bridging the gap between IT and manufacturing at their Silicon Valley AMT Tech Lab, expanding globally through their AMT Tech Centers in China, India, and Mexico, along with representation in Europe and Brazil. Custom research for strategic planning and member meetups that bring manufacturing leaders together. To join the AMT community, reach out to Chrissy Hahn at AMT at chahn@amtonline.org or discover more at amtonline.org.
Hey, what's up, guys? Cheers. Up? Yeah. You know, got to have
something
some
like that.
Coffee, stay awake, right?
It's 5 o'clock somewhere, baby.
Something like that, exactly.
Well, yeah. I don't drink every afternoon, but I just figured I was more tolerable on the podcast.
Yeah, we're in the virtual boring bar, so.
If the sound of a machine tool removing metal gets your blood pumping, then you are Metalworking Nation. This is Making Chips, where we talk all things metalworking, engineering and design, production and tooling combined with business best practices, technology, marketing, news, and new media for manufacturing professionals. Here are your hosts. Let's make some chips.
Matthew, very tolerable today. I can just tell. He's warm. He's feeling good. Mike, how you doing, dude?
I'm doing great, Nick. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm real good. So if they're watching the video, we did get the cameras. We did get the cameras to work, right? So
yeah, we were struggling before.
Yeah.
A bunch of old men trying to figure out technology.
What'd you say, Matthew? And I asked you if you got that new email working. You said something like...
You're talking to me about technology. Talk to me like I'm a
7-year-old. Yeah, doing a digital podcast over the internet.
So Mike's calling me right now.
And I'm the one with all the gray hair.
I was just going to say, it's kind of like the reverse here.
My wife gets so pissed at me because I can't do anything. I just don't have patience for it. And just, I don't know, just fat finger everything. I just can't deal with technology.
You got to do what my dad does. He goes, he'll like give someone compliments because he doesn't feel like doing something. So he'll be like, you know what you're really good at? Sending emails. I like the way you write. Will you write up an email? That's like, thanks, Dad. I can't wait. Yeah. It's like, you just don't feel like doing it, right, Dad?
I was in the technology space 20 years ago, and people still think I understand it. It's changed a little.
Yeah. Ain't that the truth? And we're about to record a nice one about some scanning technology for the next episode. That'll be cool.
That'll be interesting. Matthew, you guys...
And you do some scanning, right?
Yeah, you're talking about like laser scanning?
Yeah.
We got a Faro laser scanner. It is kick-ass, man. It's been a game changer.
Yeah, that's really cool.
We do a lot of custom fabrication, a lot of plant work, really complicated structures inside of plants with piping and conduit and stuff going everywhere. And you used to field measure all that. Now we're scanning it. It's incredible.
Did you see Mike's post about that dash he's building?
No, I didn't see that.
Preview the next episode, Mike, real quick.
Yeah, preview it. I'm building a 1959 Ford F-100, and we needed to recreate some parts and used our laser scanner along with Ira from Rapid3D, and they were able to model out the part for us. We're machining it now. So our next episode will be with Ira talking about that process and kind of the technology in general. That'll be pretty entertaining.
Yeah. That sounds
cool. How do you guys go from scan to CAD, Matthew, like when you do it?
You're over my head, buddy. That was an ordeal. It took a while because there's a software that goes between. So we run SolidWorks for the CAD. So there's something that goes between the Faro scanner that they export it to that then brings it into the solid model so that they can build on it, build our CAD model right onto the scan. But that's all over my head. I'm not even going to attempt
it. I get it.
We have smarter people than me that do that.
Mike, yeah,
that was the experience we went through, and Ira was, he helped us out. It was a really neat experience. Amazing technology.
They're probably, if anybody listens to what I just said, they're probably going to be like,
yeah, he is. So they're going to be like, he is a 70-year-old, man. You look good for 70.
You do.
Hey, Mike, we got a segment we always rock with, and yours was something about chip on your shoulder. Something's pissing you off, right? You got that?
I absolutely have a chip on my shoulder.
Are you tired of putting out fires? Is the coolant starting to go bad? Are your cutting tools edgy, or is that just how you're feeling? Chances are, we've been there too. So, we have to ask, what's the chip on your shoulder?
So, what is this chip on your shoulder, Mike?
Well, Nick, this is a couple years in the making, but one of our customers that we do quite a bit of work with, a lot of different work, not necessarily a whole lot of the same thing all the time. A couple of years ago, we had gotten into a groove. We were making these couple parts for them at a pretty good pace, maybe 100 parts a month, something like that, in addition to other stuff. And those kind of faded away and some other stuff picked up, which is very normal with them. So didn't pay a whole lot of attention to it until very recently. It kind of came back up from one of our vendors reached out to us. They were needing help getting some parts made for one of their customers. And we go looking at it, and it's the work we used to do, that we used to buy the material from that vendor to make the parts for. And looking through that, we find out our vendor, we had a common customer, took the parts from us. They're not a machine shop, and outsourced that work to other people in town.
It's going to be hard to retain business, dude.
Right.
For this vendor.
So through a lot of searching and figuring things out, yeah, I just found out we lost the work to our vendor that we were buying the material from to make the parts. That's since been worked out and lots of things going on there. But I learned several things out of it. One was I need to pay more attention to my product mix with my customer. Wonder why. I should have wondered a year ago why we quit making those parts. This customer in particular, they just kind of ebb and flow with different parts. So if you hadn't asked the question, it wasn't abnormal, right? We didn't drop off necessarily revenue with that customer. It was the type of parts we were making for them changed. It also just raised some questions about how do you manage your relationship with your vendors and make sure that you're staying on top of those types of things.
Yeah, I mean, what you just described is a bit abnormal. I imagine not everybody's dealt with that exact situation, but just the whole trust in your supply chain and your suppliers and your vendors is a big topic. And it has been ever since COVID, right? So,
you know, we work pretty actively to manage our supply chain. So years and years ago, you know how you hear a quote sometimes and it validates the way you do business. You're like, yeah, that's what I do. So years ago, a mentor and business partner of mine shared with me a quote by a guy named Mark McCormack, I believe is his name. He wrote a book called What They Didn't Teach You at Harvard or something like that. And his quote was, all things being equal, people will do business with friends. All things being unequal, people will do business with friends. And quite frankly, I mean, I've kind of built my career on that, both as a vendor to others and as a customer to others, right? I try not to worry as much about, try to build a relationship on both sides of that where I'm not as worried about price as I am our trust and the relationship and all that. And on-time delivery and quality are obviously important in what we all do. And if I'm getting those types of things, do I really care about 2% here or there, 4%, whatever? Probably not, right? If I know I can get what I need when I need it and it's the right thing, there's value to that. Honestly, that has been wildly successful for me, as I think it is for most people.
I mean, do you think that's true, Matthew? Like, to me, it's usually true, but there's a limit to the all things being unequal. Like, how unequal can you be, right? If you're 40% higher and I think you're the freaking coolest guy ever, I'm going to go buy from some guy I don't even like that.
Yeah,
much.
Well, right. But I mean, yeah, I mean, obviously, yeah, the guy would make a point.
Sure, sure.
Quote. I mean, of course. But I think, yeah, if the relationship's there and it's the kind of people, you have some shared values there. I'm going to say, hey, Nick, you're way high. Like something's not right here. You probably need to take another look at that. So yeah,
I think that's the biggest thing, because a friend would tell you that, and a friend will tell you where you need to be. And then a friend would get there if you can. And that's probably where the quote validates itself.
Or say, hey, man, you need to buy that from them. I mean, I can't get there.
Yeah, I've done that.
Good luck. And if it doesn't, yeah.
And I've been told that.
So, I mean, it seems like, Mike, it sounds like, I mean, we're all in agreement kind of on the way you do things in your principle. It sounds like this situation's got you questioning some things a little bit, that relationship and relying on the vendor. I mean, why don't you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, it certainly made me kind of revisit, am I doing business with friends or am I not, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, business with friends, all the valid reasons in the world, maybe that work's going to leave me, would have at least justified the conversation, right? Mm-hmm.
It's like, do you think they knew you were doing the work?
I know they did.
Okay, because that's, I mean, you know, it is possible that you're just buying steel from somebody and they're not really paying attention
sure.
to where it's going or what it's doing, and that could have worked its way around. I have found situations, I've been on both ends of the situation where we accidentally sort of stepped on each other's toes.
Sure.
Both as a customer and as a supplier. And I feel like if you're honest with people and you have a relationship, you can work through that. But then there's some people that, yeah, are intentionally trying to do that.
Yeah, and I think this was probably a mix, right? I don't know that it was entirely intentional, but it also wasn't communicated, right? There wasn't the transparency you'd want there out of a good, friendly relationship between each other. I think, Matthew, you and I probably share a little bit more of a commonality on the fact that we run small businesses. We are both intimately involved as a vendor and as a buyer, right? So, I mean, we have to balance those relationships with our clients. We want that trust relationship with our clients. We also want it with our vendors. Nick, you probably bring a little bit different perspective leading a large sales team. You probably have more of the vendor, being the vendor side of this.
Yeah, like so sales and marketing. So on marketing, I have way more suppliers, like people on, sure. if you want to call them suppliers, but they're sure. providing services to me and I'm making a lot of money doing it and they do a good job. But on the sales side, like, yeah, we're the ones that people are going to, we got to build trust. It's all about trust in sales and people got to know. Perfect example that comes to my mind is we're an integrator for a variety of work holding companies from Schunk to Fifth Axis yeah. to Triag or whatever. And if it's a Venn diagram, there's some parts where all three overlap. For example, all three of those brands make a self-centering vice. They're all about $1,200 or whatever, right? So if one of their sales guys brings me into an opportunity because they want the application support, they want it all modeled up on a tombstone or something like that, you know, I go in there and be like, you know what would even work on here? How about this other one? It's like, if all things are equal and there's no real advantage to the end customer, like how foolish would I be to bring up anything other than who brought me into that place? Next time they're going to bring me into one. But it is kind of a balancing act too, because part of our value prop as the integrator is they're not just going to push me in one direction because they have all their eggs hooked to one brand, right? So when the end user comes directly to us and says, hey, how would you do this? Then it's more like, well, here's three different ways to do it. Which way do you prefer? And kind of lay it out there for them and kind of do whatever is best for them. So,
you know, one of the things I've tried to do through this process is understand, you know, I've tried to put myself in the position of the vendor to say, okay, they needed to make sure that that end customer was using their material for those parts, mm-hmm. right? That was their purpose. So to some extent, fair game, right? If the best way they can secure that is to say, okay, we want you to use this material to make the parts. How about we provide you the parts? Okay. I mean, I get that.
But I don't understand why they brought it back to you to look at it if they knew you had it in the first place.
I don't think we know the answer to that. I think there's a few different theories on why we
didn't. There's the dumb part for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think they got in a bind and needed some help and that maybe the person that did bring it back to us didn't realize.
It slipped through the cracks, didn't it?
Yeah. I think there was maybe a little lack of communication on their end internally that brought it to my attention.
We've been a part of stuff like that too. People can get kind of.
Yeah. Sometimes it can seem like it's malicious intent or there's some integrity issues or whatever. And really it's just like terrible communication in a cluster, but there also could be some integrity issues involved. And what does our parents all tell us about lying? You know, never start lying because then you got to keep lying and then right. you can't remember. Oh, shit, what is the truth here? Yeah.
I would be inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt and try to dig to the bottom of it. I'll give you an example. I was on the other end of the situation. This didn't happen long ago. So one of our big customers is a supplier. So they don't really perform anything. They move a lot of product, but they have custom folks like us that help mm-hmm. them. Their customer, who we work closely with, so that the customer knows that we're the one supplying the parts. Their customer was hell bent on going straight to the suppliers. They hired a new purchasing guy, right?
Straight to Nick's then, or straight to...
Yep, everybody on sure. all facets of the business. This was an OEM.
Gotcha, okay.
OEM manufacturer. They had brought in a new purchasing guy. He was hell bent on getting rid of all the middlemen. And he told us point blank that they were not going to deal with our customer, the supplier. It's not happening. We're going to take it overseas. We're going to do something else. So we engaged in a conversation with them one-on-one and said, all right, well, let's at least talk about pricing. So if you're going to take it somewhere, Let's talk about that. And then we were going to go back to the customer. Well, we did. Going to go back to our customer once we'd hashed all that out and say, listen, we just want to be above board with you. We want you to know what's going on here. And that's what happened. But we weren't going to do that until if there was something material to even talk about. And we felt like it would be foolish business of us to not at least position ourselves at the table to have a conversation.
No, you have
and
to.
And so we went back to our customer and we got our hands smacked. They got pretty ticked off about it. To your point, Nick, they thought there was malicious intent and they said, you should have came to us right away. In hindsight, maybe we should have. I don't know. I mean, it's easy to say it in hindsight. It was like, you don't want to ruffle any feathers if there's nothing to talk about. Mm-hmm. And we didn't bring the situation up to begin with. So, but we got our hands smacked over it from the customer and it was a dicey and there was never any malicious intent. It just sort of unfolded that way. So I guess all I'm saying, Mike, is be interesting to know how that all unfolded.
Yeah. I mean, we've had some conversations, you know, I'm not going to get into all the details of that because they were, you know, there were some pretty tense conversations around some of that. But, and it's working out fine now. We're back to making the parts and the end customer and our vendor. I mean, we're cranking them out. It's going great. And, you know, at the end, it all worked out. And I just, you know, I think had there been more transparency on the front end and maybe there wouldn't be a crack in that trust, right? I think I understand the motivation behind it all. There was just clearly a break in communication that happened there. Again, it has made me kind of reevaluate how we're doing business. I mean, think about this scenario. And Matthew, I'm sure you have this. Nick, you probably are on the receiving end of this, except you're dealing on such a more national, regional scale, maybe that you don't see it directly. But, you know, there's, I don't know, Matthew, in our case, there's probably 4 to 5 main material vendors we go to when we're quoting a new job. They're the local 4 or 5 top ones, right? I mean, I'm assuming that they know everybody that's bidding the job for XYZ customer, right? If I need this special material of this certain size and this certain length, and I'm asking them for it, there's probably 2 to 5 other shops that are as well. So they know that customer XYZ has gone to these 4 shops and said, where are we at? Give us a price on this. Now that vendor now has the opportunity to kind of help decide that in some ways, right? I mean, how they quote that material to each of us could be the difference in who wins that job.
Yeah.
So I can't take the approach of the vendor just serves me, right? I have to be valuable to that vendor too, because I need a good relationship with them to provide me material at a good price and good timing and all that.
There's a lot of positioning, politicking that goes on and all that. We just lost a huge job down at a new battery plant being built. This was on our industrial coating side, but the vendor helped. It was spec'd with a certain material. The vendor helped bring us to the table. We won a couple small jobs, knocked it out of the park, performed well. The on-site contractor saying, you guys are going to do all the work. And the spec was written only with our vendor's product. So we bid the big scope. We thought, well, we got this thing locked up. And we didn't get greedy. We bid it with a normal margin. We've already been on site. We've already performed. We're in here with the vendor. And we found out we didn't get the job. And the vendor checked at their national office to see if anybody else was bidding, because they would have to call this company, right, to get a quote. No one else was bidding it. And we find out we didn't get it. And it's like, what the hell? Well, guess what? Somebody backdoored and changed the spec.
Oh.
And we always submit, when you're quoting something with a really high-end spec, we always submit an alternative. But in this case, we didn't, because it's like, we're not going to try to go around our vendor that brought us to the table. Sure. We wouldn't even be at the dance if it wasn't for them. And it ended up costing us the job. So, man, there's a lot of positioning that happens on these deals.
Yeah, and it's not, there's no like easy black and white answer. We want to leave the audience with takeaways. How much trust should you put in your supply chain? And when you're the supplier, how much transparency should you provide? I think we all agree, like, it's important to operate with integrity and not lie. But I've got big OEM customers that say, yeah, you know, we're going to want transparency. Like, yeah, okay, we'll be transparent. And they want you to show them everything, you know, they want to know every detail of what you got going on. And it's like, well, you're not entitled to that, right? You'd be super transparent. But have either of you ever asked for like the exact margins that your customers are making or, you know, your vendors are making? I'd feel like, I don't know, because we're all leaders, okay? And we lead the people in our company. We got to be good stewards to our customers. We got to be good partners to our vendors and everything. But at the end of the day, we're trying to maximize our profits for our business. We're trying to bonus our people. And yeah, you can do that without being greedy.
We have a responsibility to maximize the profitability of the business. I mean, that responsibility is fundamental to do that. And getting the lowest price is part of that. but there's a limit to that. So to your point, Nick, there can be a lot of gray area, but the best you can do is clarify what's black and white. So for example, one thing we did was we said, you don't give somebody the order just because they're your friend or whatever. People've got to be, the price has got to be right. But we do not do reverse bidder tactics. So like Mike, if you were bidding against Nick, I'm not going to share Nick's price with you and say, can you beat that? You can get away with that a time or two and you'll get a better price. But not only is that, not only is it lacking integrity, that's going to come back to bite you in the end. Because pretty soon, Mike's going to figure that out and Mike's going to go, well, screw you.
Right.
I'm not bidding to you.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah.
So that's just one
example. I mean, what do you guys, put yourself in my shoes. You got a big OEM customer that could buy maybe $10 million of product. They're asking for transparency and they want to know everything. What your people make, what you commission people, what they want to know too. So, I mean, I'm always like, oh, you know, I'll give you this and that, but I can't do all of it.
I mean, that's a tough one. I can't say that.
Well, they use a word real quick before you answer. They use a word transparency to make it seem like, oh, a good person would be transparent. You sure. know, so they use that word. Anyway, go ahead.
I don't think I've ever been asked that question specifically. Yeah. I mean, I've certainly been in those conversations. Certainly what I always tell any customers in that case is like, look, you want me to be successful. Right. I mean, you want me to be profitable. You want me to be successful. You want me to be able to provide salaries that keep good people and retain them. Because if I'm not, then I'm going to be out of business. Right. And then I'm not going to Hill's promise to our customers is we deliver quality parts on time every time. Well, if I'm not hitting certain margins and so forth, then I'm not going to be able to do that. Right. I can't invest in my people and my processes and equipment and tooling and so forth to do that on a day to day basis. So I don't shy away from it. I guess I generally in those conversations have been more just, look, that doesn't matter. But what matters, you know, try to turn it back to, I'm going to deliver you quality parts on time every time. And the costs associated with that are covered in the price that I'm quoting you.
Yeah. And you're getting a quote from somebody else. So yeah, you want customers that appreciate and value that. And if they don't, I mean, that's an extreme example, Nick. I mean, big one $10 million customer. I mean, where none of us are fortunate enough to tell them to go take a hike. But, right. you know, in general, I would just say you want to focus your energy on customers that value that. I mean, for example, so we've got a set of guiding principles and one of our guiding principles says treat vendors as part of the team. And then there's general, we all get that. But under that, one of the things it says is our vendors need to be successful. That's your point you're making right there, Mike. Like if we just beat the hell out of our vendors all the time, and not that we're big enough that we have that much leverage, but I'm just using that as an example. If you beat the hell out of your vendors all the time, just try to squeeze everything you can out of them and they're not successful and they don't want to do business with you, it's not going to be a good long-term vendor. We need them to be successful.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. Yeah, like it's a short-term thought and you got to change it to a long-term conversation.
Yep.
So
one of the other things that says under that guiding principle is cheaper isn't always better. Sometimes we got to look at the big picture here. Mm-hmm. Maybe one vendor is a little bit cheaper, but like Mike said, do they deliver on time?
Are they going to answer the phone if you got an issue? You know,
yes, the $1,000 we're saving on that material going to be holding up a $100,000 job that we can't get out the door and we can't invoice.
Yeah.
I mean, with this topic kind of being vendor management, I mean, I don't think there's anything we buy we treat as commodity, right? Even though, I mean, you could argue everything we buy is a commodity, right? I mean, metal sells by the pound.
But I don't think there's a right or wrong way. I'm not saying you're wrong, but we do. We have like commodity vendors and then not, and we don't apologize for that. It's like we're buying steel. I mean, right. Let's be honest, guys. It's a commodity. I mean, you bring me raw material on a semi truck.
Right.
The value you can bring to me over price is will it be on time and will it be right?
Mm-hmm.
But it's a commodity.
In our case, we don't shop every job we run, right? I mean, when we're quoting a job, we do. And we'll send it out to, say, four vendors or whatever. And I would say, in general, we kind of stick with the one that got us there, right? We have margin built into our material. If it fluctuates up and down a few percent here and there, that's okay, right? I mean, it's absorbed in the cost. Could we be a little more diligent? And could I add a couple points to my bottom line? Probably. I mean, just in all fairness, yes. I mean, I certainly probably could. But I do see value in those relationships. I mean, where we then look to treat that more as commodities when we look at, say, okay, this is now something that we can do a mill run of because of the orders that the customer's committed to. And at that point, then, yeah, we might work with three different vendors to look at what they're willing to do on a mill run of something. But
yeah, but just because something's a commodity doesn't mean you only focus on price. I'm just saying right. that relationship doesn't really impact it as much because
it doesn't.
I mean, it's price and delivery. But you know,
three inch 1018 from everybody's the same 3 inch 1018.
Right. Exactly right. And we have jobs all the time. We could buy from the mill and get a little bit less price, but we have built a really good relationship with one of our primary steel suppliers. And we've negotiated a mill cost plus with them. And we have good payment terms with them. They also warehouse it for us. Yeah. So there's some value add there above a commodity. And we recognize that. And therefore, we'll pay a couple points extra to buy it from them as opposed to the mill, because they've been a long-term partner of ours. They're bringing some value to the table. So,
I mean, there's definitely clearly different categories there. Like you said, steel to some degree. The opposite end of that spectrum is like, hey, can you build me a custom fixture to hold these?
Right.
You could go to five different companies and get five different products. One of them might be way more expensive, but you like the way that it's more repeatable or that there's hydraulics or whatever, right? So it's like, in that case, you're really trusting the people, the ingenuity, the integrity, the delivery.
Right.
Is it going to work? If it doesn't work, are they going to be there to fix it within a reasonable time? So you can't just broad brush.
So on a commodity product, the key is to engineer ways to add value beyond price, and working with the suppliers should be trying to do that, obviously, but working with them to say, hey, what if we did this? You know, I mean, I think that's a two-way conversation.
Sure.
I think the frequency that you jump into stuff matters too. Like where you dive into, on my side, it's like, sometimes I got to talk about price increases. It is what it is. And if every single time they ask us to quote something, I'm like, might be a price increase. Like every time it's too much. They're going to be like, hey, chill out, man. But if I never do it, look at inflation, right? And on the flip side, it's like, you know, I don't know if you guys have commercial insurance brokers that you deal with, but like, do you go out for bids every single year? Or do you not? Right. Yeah, at some point, you trust the guy. So how often you do it has a role to play. I think you were saying, Mike, like, we don't go out for bids every single time we run the job.
Right.
On steel.
Yeah, we check it. I mean, we kind of spot check it. But yeah, I mean, if we generally buy this job, when we're running this job, we buy it from this vendor. We stick there. I mean, again, could we make improvements? Probably so. I mean, I'm sure we're giving up a couple points on that. But it also, I think those are also the reasons that customer calls me, has a rush job. They'll drop that material off today because I'm giving them a little something. They're giving me a little something. Nick, the point you just brought up. So put myself on the other side of the table. I've got a customer right now that, so when I bought Hill 6 years ago, as they were ordering parts, and we were certainly after we had implemented ProShop and we had better understanding of our job costs and so forth, we realized that we were accepting POs at pricing that was from like, so I bought it in 2018. You know, we were accepting jobs at pricing from like 2012. So even today, now 6 years later, there's still times jobs come through at PO prices that are 10 years old. And we're saying, yeah, we've requoted that now. Here's your new price. And one of my key customers, they still are going through some price changes due to that, plus the volatility of the material market over the last 3 years, 2 years especially. Now, it seems to be stabilizing. It seems to be coming back down, but they've been pushing me real hard to commit to 12-month pricing that I won't do.
And yeah, you're like, I was giving you 12 to work out 12 years ago.
Exactly. And even as recently as a couple months ago, you know, we're sitting in this meeting and they're saying, we really need a 12-month commitment to pricing. And my point to them is, okay, but that's going to hurt you, not me.
Yeah, I was going to say, you're not going to like the price.
Right. Because I've got to protect myself at the current material prices, and assuming they could jump like they did the last 2 years, right?
Yeah.
And you're really better off, as I told them, I was like, I mean, I can commit to like 90 days, right? Because I know your volumes. I know what we make for you in 90 days. I know my spot price on that material today. I know what my labor is. I can commit to that for 3 to 4 months. But if you want a year, I've got to protect myself. Right? I mean, And it's an ongoing conversation, and we differ in the approach to it. They're saying, yeah, but we're going to commit this volume to you. Like, that's great. But if the material doubles again, you know, we run parts today. Matthew, I'm sure you're the same way. We've been running for 40 years, right? And the material today, just the raw material today, costs what 5 years ago we charged for the completed part. That's not uncommon at all. We come across that, I mean, not daily, but certainly on a somewhat regular basis.
Yeah, but back to Nick's point about transparency. I mean, we have done deals where we will fix it and fix it on the material is going to be a cost plus a margin, and then just share the material cost with customers. So
that's pretty transparent. That.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I would say back to the frequency point, you know, if we're thinking like shop owners right now, some jobs you don't need to check every single part, right? You check every fifth part, every 10th part, every 100th part. Because if you checked every single part, you kill yourself with efficiencies. And it's kind of like that with pricing being something that's variable every single time, right?
Yeah, well, it's like relationship equity, right?
Yeah. I mean,
you got to put deposits into the relationship bank account, and vendors are no different.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you care about your vendors and you want to have a good long-term relationship, you got to put deposits into the account too. And a deposit would be buying from them without beating them up.
Mm-hmm.
And, or we buy nuts and bolts from a couple different places. We've got this lady that I've been doing business with forever, and she drops whatever she's doing to bring like $10 worth of grinding discs out. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They had a big bolt order one time. It was several thousand dollars, and they put it out for bid, and she was a few hundred dollars more, and they didn't give it to her. And I kind of smacked her hand. I said, guys, man, she bends over backwards for you guys. Like, come on, man. You know, and so that's what I mean by.
Exactly. Yeah. Because that's worth something.
Yeah. But when you get that huge job where you really need your vendor on your side, say, look, we got to win this together. I need you to do everything you can on this with tighten up, figure out how you can help me with this. How can you help me with that? Can you warehouse some of it for me? Can you help me on my payment terms? Whatever it is, if you've paid into that relationship equity, then you can pull on that bank account when you need it,
right,
when it really counts.
If you ask for every single time, some sort of pricing negotiation, it's too much. But if you wait 12 years, to Mike's point, then all of a sudden they get this crazy increase because you have to even make money. And we had the same situation, Mike. We had one leader of a business unit who just didn't do anything with pricing for years. And then when you did, the customer felt like we were really
you're
dishonest. Right. Like, what are you screwing me here? And it's like, no, I've actually been screwing myself the whole time. But it feels more honest when there's like a reasonable cadence, not too much and not too rare, you know?
Yeah. And I think that, you know, going back to our normal practice, I think that's probably the best way to describe it is once we know we're in a comfortable spot with somebody on them being the vendor for this product line or whatever program we're working on, we don't go back and revisit it all the time, right? We order that material from them. If we start to see changes in that and it starts to affect our margins, then that's when we might revisit that. But you know, Matthew, to your point, the scenario that started this whole conversation, those parts we were making, we had worked directly with that vendor to work out the pricing on that material for those parts so we could even get it to start with, right? And then, you know, you fast forward 18 months and they've gone direct. That's where this whole kind of vendor trust scenario came up for me.
That's a tough one, man.
That one. It was tough.
Yeah, just to pivot a little bit, one thing I wanted to share with the listeners that I think could be a decent takeaway. We started doing this a couple of years ago, and this is on the vendor topic, not related to trust, but we were talking about commodity and transparency and different things, and it's related to that. So we were having challenges with several of our vendors with late deliveries and quality issues and things. And so we started doing I don't remember if we do it quarterly or every 6 months, one of the two. It's at least every 6 months and it might be quarterly. But one of our folks puts together a really nice spreadsheet. So we track vendor issues. We do it right in our quality issue. So in our quality management system, we have like a drop-down menu that anybody on the shop floor, anybody in the office can hit like a reason code, which you can do it in Excel or anything, but they have to pick a reason code for the quality issue. So we just put a bunch of vendor, like vendor late delivery, vendor made part wrong, whatever. So then we can sort those and we put out a report to all our vendors. And I actually suggested we do this. We took it a step further and I said, all right, here's what I want you to do. I want the vendors to see who else is on that report and I want them to see where they scored compared to the average. So like, Mike, you couldn't see how Nick scored, but you could see how you scored compared to the aggregate.
And you would know Nick was part of the aggregate.
And you would know Nick was part of the aggregate. Right. I think
that is so fair.
That's very fair.
Frankly, I wish our customers would do that for us. Sure. Like, I mean, let's
just put it out. Well, as you say that, I'm like grinning because I wish I could share my screen right now and show you, but we have kind of two different sales initiatives, you know, new development initiatives to turn targets into key accounts. And then we got key accounts. They do business with us consistently. And how do we get as much as we can out of them and provide as much value to them, right? And so one thing that we're implementing is these quarterly customer success reviews. And so in that, we ask a series of questions. It's not about like this job or that job necessarily. It's more about the relationship. And one of them is like, so how do you rate your suppliers? What are the criteria that you're using? What's our score? How does our score compare to the average? And if we're not getting a 10 out of 10, what could we do to get a 10 out of 10?
That's brilliant because you're basically telling them, tell me how you keep score.
Right, because I want to win. I want to make you successful.
I want to win, and I don't know how to win if you don't tell me.
And then if they don't keep score, it's like, well, could we help you create a way to keep score?
Because when they start keeping score, they might find out you're a lot better than what they thought.
Yeah, and like how to talk about transparency. I want to know exactly what it takes for you to win so I can help you win.
Yeah, let me give you a quick example of that. So when we put that report out, we have one steel supplier that we have issues with all the time. And don't get me wrong, they need to get better. And the guys on the shop floor were like, that place sucks. We're always having issues with them. Well, we ran the report. Guess what? Their percentage of issues was the lowest of any vendor.
Oh, wow.
Just buy the most from them.
Yeah.
So put the data on, they actually are performing better than anybody else.
Yeah, because if you just based on how many times you felt that pain, if you just swap them out with somebody else, it could be 10 times worse.
You feel it a lot. Yeah. Exactly right.
Yeah, so it's crazy.
I love that as a takeaway because we use ProShop.
Mm-hmm.
ProShop has a lot of vendor rating built in, right? Mm-hmm. So with every line item of a PO I send a vendor, I can rate them on a scale of 1 to 5.
And Mikey's getting ProShop a hell of a plug.
I know. Right. Paul doesn't even have to show up for the episode and he gets a plug.
Man, he,
I got the cup too.
Well, in that case, I'm drinking out of a Hennig mug.
Send him a bill, Nick.
Right. So we can leverage that scoring system internally, but we have not shared it. That's a great idea. We can rate per line item on a PO. Quality, price, delivery.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember what all's on there.
Yeah, and ours is just a performance report. So it has late, how many deliveries were late, how many had issues, et cetera. And then it gives them a total issue and then percent of shipment. So
that
shipped us 3,000 times and you had 32 issues.
So that's the report I can get out of this too. Now, I will say we leave it default a lot, right? We don't go in and do enough scoring,
mm-hmm.
but it is part of our ISO review
mm-hmm.
to have that information. But I hadn't thought about the step of, the kind of that next step of sharing that with the vendors, say, hey, here's where you rank. I mean, my customers do that with me, right? I mean, my top 5 or 6 customers, I go in annually for my scorecard review and they show me where I stand.
I love that. I want that to be a standard. Like if you don't like that, then you got problems. You know?
No, I look forward to those meetings and they show me where I stand in price and quality and mm-hmm. on-time delivery and all that. And we talk about ways to improve. And it also lets me know that this vendor, they prioritize on-time delivery over price. This one delivers price over quality, whatever.
Yeah, because they don't all value the same elements equally.
Right, which affects our pricing to them. It affects mm-hmm. a lot of things. That buyer persona, what matters to that customer, that's super how important. We're bidding that job.
Right.
But I don't take that out to my vendors. So that's a great takeaway.
Well, and what I love about what Matthew's doing is just like it shows a lack of integrity if I shared your price with Matthew and Matthew's price with you, he doesn't. He shares your price with you and your rating with you.
Right.
And how you stack up against the average. He doesn't say,
right.
Because I think that's the right way to do it.
Yeah, there's a lot of value in that. That's good.
Yeah. It's awesome. So that's definitely some good takeaways. And as we approach 50 minutes here, we're getting near the end. But I think it was a great episode that when they go along, they typically are.
Right.
Thank you guys for joining. Enjoying it's 5:30 somewhere right now, East Coast for me. 5:30.
Right.
So, yeah.
Cheers, guys. Good talking to you.
Yeah,
cheers.
We'll talk soon. But between now and then, we have to make chips. Because when you're not making chips,
you're not making money.
Making money.
Bam.